This year for my birthday, I decided to treat myself to something completely different, a remote viewing workshop with Major Ed Dames. Ed Dames often appears on the late-night radio show hosted by Art Bell. It's called Coast to Coast AM. And when I found out that Ed was coming to Edmonton, well, the chance to meet the fellow was just too good to pass up. Ed is now retired from the American military, but he continues to use and promote the remote viewing techniques he helped to develop during his time in the military. In fact, Ed Dames plays a remote viewing instructor in the new movie, Suspect Zero. The subjects Ed and his team of remote viewers deal with cover the whole gamut from finding lost children to predicting future catastrophic events. Something Ed is particularly concerned about is what he calls the kill shot, a series of solar flares which he believes will seriously disrupt life as we know it on planet Earth. One of the reasons he decided to visit Alberta was to check out what he perceives will be safe zones from these solar flares. Now, I think that's kind of taking the Alberta advantage to the extreme, but, well, putting all the doom and gloom predictions aside, I found Ed Dames to be quite a delightful and entertaining fellow. And the workshop was a chance to open one's mind to something totally different. What follows is the interview I conducted with Ed Dames about his life work.
I'm Ed Dames. I am the director of an organization, actually a think tank, called the Matrix Intelligence Agency. And what I do for a living is teach and perform remote viewing.
We're gathered in Edmonton today at a two-day workshop that you're giving on remote viewing. What really intrigued me is the people who are here. It's mostly an older crowd, like a plus 40 crowd. Is this typical of the type of the audience that you would have in other places that you've been giving workshops?
Yes, indeed it is. To my surprise, it is. I expected more of a mixed crowd. When I taught this course professionally with very, very small groups, 2 to 3 people, those people who are committed to really learning in a vocational and professional sense are younger, are generally younger. But the groups in the workshops, the larger workshops, are generally 40 plus with a smattering of 20-year-olds.
Why are they coming?
Why? I think the predominant reason is Coast to Coast, Art Bell, the Art Bell show. So many of them have heard me speak on Art Bell, and I piqued their curiosity about what this animal called remote viewing is, and I think that's the primary reason there. Others have heard about remote viewing through other venues and have found their way to my door, but primarily in these days and times, it's Art Bell.
But beyond that, people must be looking for something or trying to learn something about things that really are poo-pooed, or they're not the status quo. Like, you just don't necessarily talk about these things in day-to-day life.
No, actually, I think it's more that the individuals want, it isn't so much that many of the people in the workshops want to learn this as a vocation and profession, as much as it is they want to know that it really exists. That the ability to do this systematic ESP called remote viewing, that this ability is real. And secondarily, they wonder if they can do it themselves at any level whatsoever. That's the primary reason they come to the workshops.
How do you define remote viewing?
Oh, I think there's several ways to do it, several ways to define it. Systematic ESP is a nice, short, terse way of describing it. We can go with that.
How did you get involved with this?
I was an intelligence officer at very high levels of the U.S. government for many years. And there were certain problems, primarily problems associated with Russian weapons of mass destruction, SS-18 missile, biochemical warfare programs, things of that ilk, that we could not, by hook or crook, solve. We couldn't use agents on the ground, photo intelligence, satellite intelligence, nothing was working. So as a tactic of desperation, the Department of Defense turned towards gifted natural psychics to see if perhaps they could provide some insight where nothing else could. That led to the idea of modeling this behavior that these natural psychics had. And when the model was developed, the question became, well, perhaps this is an innate faculty in everyone. Let's see if the model works on just somebody off the streets. And I happened to be somebody off the streets. And I squirreled my way into this prototype team of five people who this was tested on, the model was tested. In the end, to make a long story short, the prototype team became better at using this innate faculty, this sixth sense, than the best natural psychics on the planet. So it was successful beyond our wildest expectations.
Well, let's go back to where it actually started then. You say you were one of the five people off the street that this was tested on. Who took the original idea and started bringing it together?
The original, it really had its substantive seminal development in a remote viewing laboratory set up by Dr. Harold Puthoff and Dr. Russell Targ at Stanford Research Institute, now SRI International, in the late 70s, early 80s. And there's where remote viewing was born. But it wasn't the scientists, those two scientists themselves, that developed the successful model. It was their chief guinea pig, Ingo Swann, a very famous gifted artist, and one of the best natural psychics that we know of. He was the one, by studying himself, the lab rat studied himself, that came up with the fundamental model for how one could acquire psychically information about unknown, unseen targets. It was that model, after it was developed, that was taught to us, the five-member team, and it was my task to take these new techniques and methods into the deep dark world of intelligence and work out the bugs to develop remote viewing into a useful military intelligence collection tool. That was my job. It took a long time to work out the bugs, and although the bugs are worked out now, it's still evolving after 20 years, and that's how long it's been since I was tasked with doing that.
Well, can you give me some examples? What were some of the experiences that you went through in order to, you know, develop this and work out those bugs? What were some of those bugs?
Well, my mission as training officer in the Psi Spy unit, so to speak, was one hat that I wore. The other hat that I wore was operations officer. And it was really in the arena of operations where this was tested. Could we answer the mail or not? Did we succeed in finding a vehicle to answer those heretofore intractable questions? What was the makeup of the SS-18 missile? Were the Soviets really involved in the biochemical warfare program? If so, what kinds of agents were they developing? What kind of toxins, etc.? And that's by applying it, we've made a lot of mistakes. We could see our mistakes. It didn't cost lives, but it cost a lot of time and effort. And going back to the drawing board and refining this basic fundamental technique, a lot of refining and a lot of developing an awareness of when we were on target and off target, and how to set problems up correctly. It was a brand new thing, and we were babes in the woods. But we had carte blanche to test it. We had government money. We didn't have to worry about where the next meal was coming from. We could experiment in any way, shape, or form we wanted to with the fundamental theorem, and then see where it was most effective and what arenas it was most effective. Where we ended up using it most effectively was to describe the interior of inaccessible structures. What was going on in this building somewhere in China or Russia? That was very, very effective. Where we wanted to be effective but failed was in locating hostages and terrorists. We found out that that problem was far more complex than just describing the interiors and the goings-on and the details associated with the interior of a secret building.
Why is that?
For pretty technical reasons that it would take too long to go into, it would be apparent, it seemed almost counterintuitive that it might be just as easy or an easier problem to locate someone, but it, in fact it is not. We can describe the location of someone in the present time very, very easily, but we don't know where the location is. We can only describe the immediate surroundings in order to determine, because mind is outside of time and space, so to speak. We're not working in a fixed time or space. We don't know where we are in time. We don't know where we are in space. Where if you're looking at a building, for instance, there's a known. Everything we're describing about the a particular widget is in that building because that's the target. Now we have a widget or a person somewhere, but the location is unknown. So in order to establish ground truth, we have to find out where in the world we're at, what region, what city, what town, what rural area. That takes a lot of work, a tremendous amount of work. So although we can describe the locale of a target somewhere, missing or on the lam, we don't know where that target is, and that's where the work comes in. And many, many mistakes happen in that venue, especially when we were under pressure by the CIA or by Delta Force to locate the target, whether it was to kill the target or to save them.
What was it like for you the very first time that you went in, you sat down, they said, okay, we're going to do remote viewing with you? Did you have any ideas or...
The first time I ever conducted a session was with my teacher and the discoverer of remote viewing, Ingo Swann. And he was an incredibly difficult teacher, very strict, because this was an experiment and he did not want to fail. If it would have been a failure, that would have been the end of the program. So there was a lot of pressure on him, and there that pressure was passed to us to make sure that we succeeded. The criteria for success under Ingo were very, very strict. Very strict indeed, much stricter than even I use in my professional training to some degree. I could not fathom a training environment where I would be taught to be psychic. I wanted it very badly, but I just couldn't imagine it happening. So there was a great fear of failure, a tremendous amount of angst. But the protocols work in spite of your fears, in spite of your skepticism, in spite of everything, because this is a skill. So rather on, you can be kicking, drag kicking and screaming through the protocols, but by God, you're going to learn how to remote view if you attend to these steps. And that's what happened in my case, and I was awed. I was totally awed.
Well, what happened? Did you, like, when you think of psychics, you think of going in, there's a dark room, the crystal ball, or all that. What was it like for you? Were you, did you have to lie down? Did they hook you up to different instruments or anything? Or were you just sitting at a table with a light on?
We were in a room that was homogeneously colored, gray, a matte gray, and the lights were fairly dim. So there wasn't a lot of subliminal noise and background noise. And that was what the room was like. Ingo was seated across the table. My teacher was one-on-one. You couldn't go anywhere. There was no escape. He was watching every move and glaring at you to make sure that you did exactly as you were told. And that's what we had to do, exactly what we were told. It was a tremendous amount of stress. We knew if we failed, that we would not get a second chance. We would be kicked out of this off the prototype team and out of the program. And so the stress levels were high. But when we saw any degree of success whatsoever, we were so in awe that we were willing to do just about anything to continue on in the program.
What was the first thing you remote viewed then?
Let's see. The basic things in those days were generally geographic terrain that was pretty homogeneous for about 5 miles in diameter. Lakes, mountain ranges, tundra, open sea, desert, things of that nature, those basic geographical terrain targets. Those were our first targets.
So essentially, things similar to what we started off with today, mountains or lakes or roller coasters, that sort of thing?
Roller coasters we did not use. It was only we had to get 5 targets right in a row before we were allowed to move on to something more complex. If we failed to get 5 targets right in a row, the second time around, we were kicked out of the program.
What's the difference then between sort of natural psychic ability and what you're doing with remote viewing? Like, what's going on in the brain?
Well, your first question is really a non sequitur. There isn't any difference between natural psychic functioning and what we're doing. We're taking a natural and innate faculty and we're turning it into a skill. What's going on in the brain is this. The brain is an oscillator, in reality an electromagnetic oscillator, and I'm not suggesting that mind, which we know to be unitary, there's only one mind, is an electromagnetic field. There isn't any electromagnetics involved in this, but there is something like a mind field, so to speak, that holds the patterns of all information. Everything, every idea, has a pattern of information all its own through space-time. And the brain, unconscious attention, can turn itself toward any of these patterns of information in a similar fashion to a radio tuning into a specific frequency. What we do is hold that. We hold that target. The protocols, the methods and techniques allow us to take a specific pattern associated with a specific real physical object, let's say, and homestead it as long as we want and derive as much detail about that as we want. And that's essentially the model, the working hypothesis for how this is working.
You can claim a success rate of 100% when remote viewing is done properly, and yet you can go to a psychic, and they might hit on a few things, but they're not going to get everything right. Why? What's the difference?
Psychics are to have no structure. What remote viewing has done is provide a structure for a syntax and grammar, so to speak, if you will, for how unconscious communicates to conscious awareness accurately and in a very rigorous step-by-step connect-the-dots fashion. Psychics have this free-flowing, unstructured, very unrigorous manner of operating, and they lose the target. And they do not know when their imagination has pulled them off target. They don't know when they've crossed that line. As remote viewers, we do. We're taught to recognize when imagination is active, when it's interfering, when we're in danger of losing the target, and the steps to take, and how fast we need to react to correct that situation.
One of the things that you mentioned today, too, is looking at the brain waves. What's going on at the time when a person is either remote viewing, meditating, that sort of thing, whether you're dealing with the theta waves or alpha waves. What is happening there?
In meditation, which we don't do in remote viewing, in fact, it's quite the obverse. Remote viewing is the brain state is our state. Cognitively, is characterized by one of high attention, very high attention. We're attentive and alert. In meditation, one is in an alpha state, very very different a state than we are in as remote viewers, which is characterized by high theta. All of the energy of the electromagnetic activity in our brain is centered, is pushing a theta state, which is one of high attention. It's our portal to the unconscious, as a matter of fact. Meditation is the opposite.
Are there precedents for what you're doing? I'm thinking of the Tibetan monks, or maybe the skills of the Aborigines.
Well, I can't really answer that question because I'm not familiar with what, for instance, the advanced yoga cities, being able to do the kinds of things the advanced yogis do in terms of the cities as described. And I'm only familiar with what I know, with this modality here. There are certain similarities in terms of psychic functioning, but where the similarities end are here. Although we may be using the same faculty as remote viewers as, say, an Aboriginal or an advanced yoga practitioner, we are able to solve very complex technical problems using remote viewing where those individuals must use metaphor or analogy or allegory in some cases. They can't solve detailed technical problems. That's what this remote viewing was used for and why it was developed, to gather as much detailed technical information in as short a period of time as possible. And that's very unlike the process that is used by yogis and others that live in cultures that support psychic functioning.
This is something that Western culture, Western thought does not support. You were working on this, though, in a government program, a military program that was funded. Was it accepted by the people around you?
No. No, it really wasn't. Very, very few people In fact, I often call ourselves the prostitutes of the intelligence community. Everybody wanted a piece of the action at night when the red light was on. They all wanted to know what's going on. Because in Washington, D.C., knowledge is power. And this provides a real combat multiplier, an edge, politically and militarily, career-wise. But nobody wanted to associate with us in the light of day, so to speak, because they were afraid their careers would be jeopardized because they of associations or suggestions that we might be connected with the occult or something like that. It's basically fear. So there was not any real substantive support, certainly not from the higher levels, for a long period of time. But we often had a sugar daddy. A Secretary of the Army, let's say John O. Marsh at one time, or Secretary of Defense, let's say Carlucci at another time, who tolerated this program because it may have answered the mail where nothing else could, and that may be important, you know, in terms of saving lives or sussing out what a potential enemy is doing. So it was tolerated at best, but it was really... I've been involved in many, many deep, dark, black projects, but I've never seen one so labeled as a white elephant and a hot potato as the Sci-Spy Unit. Never. Nothing came close.
What brought it to an end?
It collapsed from the inside out, really. A number of things brought it to an end, but the quickest end that it... The thing that facilitated and accelerated the end were leaders in military and civilian leaders who saw this as an end-all. Not only were they supportive, but they were not balanced in terms of their support. They were too enthusiastic about this particular tool. In the intelligence business, one should not act upon intelligence unless three sources are saying the same thing. Perhaps a spy on the ground, a radio transmission, and maybe a spy photograph. If all three sources say the same thing, then you can act on the information with a pretty high degree of confidence that it's right. But two individuals in very high places saw remote viewing as an end-all. They could answer any question, and you didn't need supporting information from another venue or another int, comment, SIGINT, FOTINT, those kinds of things. That's what brought the program down, was this lack of balance in leaders that were more than enthusiastic.
If the American military was doing that, then others must have been trying to do it as well. Were they?
The Russians had a very dynamic, vibrant program, but they never learned how to train remote viewing or train psychics to do what we did. So they instead screened many thousands of people looking for gifted natural psychics, which became the core of their extrasensor. That was what they call extrasensor team, run by the KGB, and these people. One of whom I met, the operations officer after the Cold War ended, they were pretty effective as naturals. They began to develop their own structure, and even though they weren't trained, they had the structure and standardized their own behavior cognitively, and they began to produce results that were as good as ours.
Do you have an example?
Yeah. Yeah, there was... we found out that the U.S. Navy at one time, around 1986, had a very, very top secret device that they were using on board ships, and the device was visible. Soviet aircraft and helicopters could take pictures of this device, but they had no idea what it was and what it was doing. They didn't know, and we didn't want them to know because it was a top secret device too. So they sicked their team of extrasensors on this to look at its purpose, its function, its construction, where it was constructed, and those kinds of things, attendant data, to put together a picture of what this might be. And I can't talk about it because it's still classified, but they were successful in discerning what this device was used for.
Your unit was shut down eventually, and you're now doing this as a private citizen. How did you turn it into a business?
The government abandoned the program. The CIA abandoned it after DOD did. They didn't want it anymore. They threw it in the garbage. I essentially took it out of the garbage and immediately began to use it in a corporate sense. In fact, we volunteered our services. We didn't charge the government. We immediately began to use it, ironically, in support of the government. And the reason for that is this. The program, the remote viewing program, was so classified that the people that needed the information, we couldn't give it to them. We could not get the information to them because they were not briefed on the existence of the program, nor could they be. So when I took it public, I could approach the National Security Council. In fact, we did. We approached Dan Quayle, the vice president at the time, his best friend, Phil Carver, and we approached him with information about very, very important strategic things, like did Saddam Hussein leave behind a weapon of mass destruction in Kuwait when he left? Did Kuwait City hide a tactical nuclear weapon or a biological weapon or whatever? And I was able to communicate that as a businessman directly to the Vice President of the National Security Council, something I could not do before. So I was able to serve my country better on the outside than on the inside.
But eventually, you have to make money from it. Who comes to you as clients?
Well, in the beginning, we worked corporate clients. The old boy network, there were a lot of beltway bandits of defense contractors who we were able to brief and who had heard rumors that such a unit existed. And so I worked a lot of those kinds of contracts before I began teaching the public. And I only began teaching only scientists and engineers and intelligence officers. It was many years later that I opened the program up to all comers.
What are some of the things that you're trying to achieve by taking this to the general public?
Well, awareness, for one thing. Most people don't know what this animal called remote viewing is. I think Suspect Zero, the motion picture, it will be the first time that the term remote viewing is used in the feature film. That will go far towards informing the public that there's such a thing called remote viewing. And then educating the public. It's a good business as well, educating the public. Many people want what I wanted and are willing to pay for it. So I can make money as an educator as well and support myself. But my goal is a world without any secrets. That's one of my goals. The other goal is to train children so that children don't make the mistakes that we did. One of the things that remote viewing can do, one of the many things, is save a lot of resources. We can determine what resources will be necessary to solve a problem directly. It's direct knowledge, without having to experiment or undergo years of R&D, those kinds of things. That's not to say that I teach ethics. You can use the results of remote viewing, your expertise, in any way, shape, or form. But if anybody else can do that too, if you are malintended, they'll be able to suss that out and determine who did what to whom in short order. The more people that learn this, the less secrets there can be in the world. And I think that's a good thing.
What kind of secrets?
Secrets that some people think worth keeping. My favorite ones are murderers. You know, murderers don't tell anybody who they murdered. Those kinds of secrets. I think remote viewing is a great deterrent in those cases. I think that if many, many people were expert or vocational level remote viewers, it would be very difficult for a murderer to get away with a crime. A crime of passion, yeah, they're always going to happen. But a premeditated murder? No, because they'll be found out. You will know who did that, but in no uncertain terms whatsoever. You'll be able to find them. And that's the kind of secret I'm talking about, an example. Or, for instance, which nations really have nuclear weapons and where are they located? Where are the terrorists? Terrorists keep big secrets. The biggest secrets of all are kept by the U.S. Congress. I wish I were kidding, but I'm not.
Except they seem to come out at election time.
You're right. They have the most to hide, though. Take my word for it.
Actually, speaking about murderers, that's one of the things that you're doing while you're here in Edmonton.
Serendipitously, on our way to Edmonton, I noticed that the news, international news, talked about a case here in Edmonton. Apparently, there is something like a copycat serial killer who's attempting to replicate the dastardly deeds done by this pig farmer in Vancouver, a serial killer who was killing young prostitutes in Vancouver eventually captured, I think after killing 15 young women or more, to somebody else in this city operating with the same MO, apparently. So we've taken one of his alleged victims. I say alleged because the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are not sure they're dealing with a serial killer, but they think they are. And we've taken one of the victims, a 19-year-old, a young girl, Rachel Liz Quinney, and we are looking for her murderer with the assumption that he is a serial killer. We're hoping to take him off the streets and help the Mounties out in that case. And we can do that. It's within the level of our expertise. How fast we can do it is problematic.
How would you approach that?
We're going to look for the individual's primary workplace first and describe that. And hopefully that will eliminate some of the possibilities. We don't go after residences. It's too much of a homogeneous problem. Then, after we describe the workplace, we're going to look for the nearest significant feature near the workplace, whatever that may be in terms of unconscious. It could be a radio transmission tower. It could be an auto wrecking place or whatever. We'll find that. Then we'll move in closer. And we'll get some more descriptive data on the workplace itself. Let's say it's a gas station. Let's say it's an abattoir. It doesn't matter what it is. We'll be able, by finding the most significant feature, to narrow the area down so that we can turn to a topographic map into some overhead photography and say, here's our possibilities. Let's do some more remote viewing work. What's the nearest recognizable feature? What are we going to see on the ground at this place when we get there? That's how we work.
What sorts of cases have you solved or looked at in the past?
We've been very successful in Japan on missing person cases. I think my favorite, we were working on a missing child case last month in Washington, on the ground in Washington. My favorite case, because it's a happy case, TV Asahi in Japan last year had a human interest case. Captain Clifford Madison, the head of the vice squad for Portland, Oregon's police department. He is a half black, half Asian man who was adopted by an American a GI family in 1955 or 57 in Japan. And he knows that his mother was Japanese, but he doesn't know if she's alive, and he wanted to meet her. This but got picked up by the Japanese media, and they as a really nice human interest story, and they asked me if I could find, or first of all determine if his mother was alive and find out where she was geographically, and we were so successful on that case. We determined quickly that she was alive. It didn't take us long to find out that she was still in Japan, not North Carolina or whatever, and that she was in the city of Tokyo. Now there our problems begin. Tokyo is a huge city, huge metropolitan city, largest in the world, needle in a haystack type of thing. How do you find an elderly Japanese woman out of all that? That was a trick, so we had to really pull out all the stops, used all the tools in our toolbox to describe the residence for his mother, his biological mother. And that took a lot of time, but in about 4 days, my team was able to get enough descriptive information where we could, with the camera right behind us, walk Clifford up to the door, knock on it, and meet his biological mother for the first time. So that was a real stunning success story.
What cautions would you advise around remote viewing?
I think two things. Penultimately, it is a real ego pusher. If you're not in control of your ego, this is such an empowering thing, your ego will explode. I've seen this happen a number of times. You feel so empowered by learning this, your ego just explodes. So you have to keep that under control, because you become very, very special very fast, one of a very few people in the world that can do this. But more importantly, if one is emotionally or mentally unstable to begin with, learning this will send them over the edge. You can't handle the data. You can't handle what is happening to you in terms of your worldview when you learn this, because you can never look at the world again the same way. You know that you can know anything, and that is a little bit too much for somebody who's emotionally unstable, I've found.
What do you say to scientific criticism of this?
Oh, to scientific criticism? I say, shut your mouth, sit down, pick up a pen, grab that paper right there, and let me walk you through the protocols. It's the same thing as learning how to ice skate. This is a skill. Ice skating is a skill. Nobody in the world could convince me that I could put on shoes with these skinny little knife blades on the bottom and stand up, not to mention, you know, squirrel around on the ice. That can't be done. But with the right coach telling me to shut up, put these shoes on, and get me out on the ice, I could be doing what I thought would be impossible. It's easier to teach the scientists, and I've taught many of the world's best. It's easier to teach them rather than to talk about it, to let them do it themselves. That's the only way for them to accept this, I think.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a pleasure being here. You have a great newsletter, very, very professional, very informative, and I'm sure it will grow in popularity.
Thank you, Ed.
Pleasure.